this order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2109. And we'd ask Beth Ann Darby from the Board of Psychologists to come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Board of Psychologists Examiners. And we just have a short housekeeping bill for you today. It makes two changes. In the first section, we are making a change from the word and to, we'd like to change it to or. Some courts are interpreting our statute to say that you're only practicing psychology when you're diagnosing and treating. We believe that psychologists everywhere understand that you are practicing psychology when you are diagnosing or when you are treating. And we would just like to clarify that matter. And then the second section has to do with our psychologist associate program. And currently, statute requires us to provide specialty exams in specific areas of practice to psychologist associates. Board resources just won't stretch that far, and we currently examine our psychologist associates at the same level we examine our psychologists, and that program seems to be working very well, and we would just like our statute to reflect what our current practice is. And with that, if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay.
Further explanation is necessary.
I think that's pretty plain. I wish all bills were that plain. I don't have any questions myself. Public hearing on House Bill 2109 and open the work session on House Bill 2109.
Chair, I move House Bill 2109 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Castillo moves House Bill 2109 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon? Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator?
Aye. Motion carries. Would you like to? Senator Castillo will carry House Bill 2109 and close the work session on House Bill 2109 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. And at this point in time, we have no one to speak, so I'll ask the staff to introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2131 directs the State Board of Massage Technicians to impose a fee on applications for massage license exams. It eliminates the separate fees for persons applying for massage technician licenses by endorsement or reciprocity. You will notice by the final SMS off of the House side, issues that they discussed were proposals to restructure the current Board of Massage Technicians fee schedule, distinctions between regular applicants and endorsement applicants, and the House floor vote was 55 ayes, 2 nays, and one excused absence.
Okay. Notice it. Had good support in the committee, too.
Yeah.
Okay, seeing no one wishing to testify on this, I'll just go directly into a work session on House Bill 2131 and close a public hearing on it.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2131 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2131 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
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 Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Duncan, you wish to?
Sure.
Yeah. Senator Duncan, sure. And close.
I think he should massage the bill in the Senate floor.
I think he probably knows in advance that this one's good for a few of us. Close the work session on House Bill 2131 and open a public vote. Senator Shields, we had just passed 2109. You wishing to reopen 2109?
Sure. Sure.
Okay, I'll open, reopen the work session on House Bill 2109. Senator Shields, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Shields votes aye. Close the work session on House Bill 2109 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2175A. Mike Steele
Audrienne Harden?
Horton. Audrienne Horton.
Horton, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sometimes glasses just don't help.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Mike Skeels. I'm the director of the State Public Health Laboratory, which is part of the Health Division, and with me is Audrienne Horton, the manager of laboratory licensing section within the Public Health Laboratory. We're here to provide information and support for the Aiden Gross House Bill 2175, which was introduced at the request of the Health Division. This was one of our pre-session filed bills. And I've given you my written testimony. I have no intention of reading it to you, but I would like to hit some high points with your permission.
That's excellent.
Thank you. We were in the unusual situation of having to amend our own pre-session filed bill because of some unforeseen fiscal challenges that came up. But we met extensively over the months with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and the OMA and Kaiser Permanente and the managers of the many of the licensed clinical laboratories in the state that are affected by the way we do our business, and we were able to reach an agreement, and that agreement is House Bill 2175A, which passed the House, I think 59-1, and is now being heard by your committee. Just a little background, the Health Division licenses all the clinical laboratories in the state, ranging from little physician's office laboratories and solo practices all the way up through large mega labs and healthcare systems. And at present, we have about 2,000 licensed clinical labs in the state. And they're licensed at different levels depending on the complexity of the testing they do and the test volumes that they perform, how many tests per year they perform. The idea behind this program is to protect the public health by assuring the quality of the information that comes out of these laboratories, which is used as the basis for making diagnostic and treatment decisions by physicians and others. A little about the regulatory framework. There's an overarching federal law called the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments of 1988, or CLIA for short. And that's administered by the Healthcare Financing Administration, or HCFA. We also then have a state statute, which is ORS 438, which allows us to regulate clinical laboratories in a manner equivalent to CLIA. In other words, the law says you can do up to and including what CLIA does, but you can't really go beyond that. And then there's also a provision in the federal law for states to operate essentially under a waiver. If you are deemed to have a state law that's equivalent to the federal law, to the CLIA, you can get what's called exempt status. And there are only two states in the United States that have a full exempt status under CLIA. One of them is Washington and the other one is Oregon. So this has been very important to us. It's allowed us to operate under this kind of a waiver. It's allowed us to help keep our costs down because we've had lower fees for the licensed clinical laboratories. And it's also allowed us to provide a different kind of program than the federal government would be providing in terms of doing more consultation, more technical assistance, working with laboratories to help them correct problems and find the right level for themselves, and to adopt a more, let's say, localized way of doing things. Now, that's the framework that we're operating on. And this bill changes ORS 438 in three ways. And the first one I want to mention is really listed as second in my testimony, but it's the big one in this bill, and that is it changes the licensing fee structure for clinical laboratories. In the past, we've had some absolute dollar caps in there, and we were indexed to 90% of the corresponding fee which the federal government would be charging these same laboratories if they were doing the program, in other words, if we did not have the exemption. And as amended, however, this House Bill 2175A would set our fees at no more than 95% of the federal fee for the first year of the biennium and no more than 100% in the second year, and this would become effective this July 1st, July 1st of 99. And this change is necessary for a couple of reasons. First of all, we have had higher administrative costs, and we did anticipate some of those in the governor's budget. But then we got a really nasty surprise from the federal government, from HCFA, between the time that we got our initial exemption approval and this legislature gave us the authority to seek that exemption and the time that that this bill was drawn up. We learned that the federal government wants to charge exempt states for essentially for the privilege of doing the federal government's work on their behalf. They want to charge us and are charging us a franchise fee, what I'm calling it, which is, in our case, has been $70,000 a year, and they're currently bumping that to $75,000 a year. And the rationale behind this is that they need to, part of the money, a very small part, about $16,000, is to go behind us and make sure that we're doing things the way that the federal government would like to see them done in terms of validation, inspections, and surveys. And we actually have no quarrel with that because we think that will help us continually improve our program. But the rest of the fee is an administration and maintenance fee. And we've been in long and extensive dialogue with the federal government about what the nature of that fee is, why they feel that they need to charge it. We're in the process of challenging their legal authority to charge that fee. We are currently working with our congressional delegation on a delegation letter to HCRA about the fee. Senator Wyden and Senator Smith's office have both been involved in contacting HCRA about the fee. We are, in other words, we are turning the pressure way up on the federal government to try to get relieved of this fee if we can. However, for the next two-year period, it looks like we're going to be paying $75,000 a year, which is about 15% of our program income, to the federal government for this fee. So that, combined with the other expenses, increases in expenses for personnel and one thing and the other, lead us to ask for this change in fee structure. And I want to reiterate that this has all been worked out with the people who are being regulated. And on the House side, the Hospital Association testified in support of this bill. And I can't speak for them, but they are on the record as seeing that this is okay.
I'm sure they knew that this was posted in this. They wouldn't have been in agreement. I think they would have had their presence in other churches.
Senator Fisher, you are quite right. There are a couple of other changes in this bill besides the fee structure change. One of them is that it changes our underlying state law so that if physicians, regardless of the size of their practice, regardless of the number involved in the practice, if they're performing moderate or high complexity testing under the federal jargon, then they will have to be licensed as a moderate or high complexity test in the same way that a large clinic or a small hospital laboratory would be licensed if they were performing the same level of testing. Now, the reason we need that change is that under our state statute, there is a clause that says if fewer than five physicians are in practice and running a laboratory, that they're exempt from all licensure, regardless of the complexity of the testing that they're doing. Well, as long as we have a federal law in place that requires that everybody is licensed, that's fine. But there is an amendment called the Archer Amendment, named after its author, of course, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. This amendment would remove physicians' office labs from licensure nationally. It would say that any physician's office, and we don't know exactly how narrow or broad the definition of that would be, but any time a physician is in practice and operating his or her own laboratory, they would be exempt from clinical laboratory regulation. If that passes, then what would happen in Oregon is we would revert to our state statute that says any time that fewer than five physicians are in practice, no matter how complex or how high volume their laboratories are, they would be completely exempt from licensure of any kind, either federal or state. So what this does is put in a safety net to assure that in Oregon, even if the Archer Amendment passes nationally, if you're performing tests that are moderate or high complexity, you would fall under the statute. And we have had no objection from the Oregon Medical Association on this. We met with their legislative committee, and they did not testify on the House side, but they have not objected to it. And of course, we think that this is just good common sense because if you're doing a pap smear to diagnose cervical cancer, or you're looking at people's blood to see if they have leukemia, or testing their blood to see if they have hepatitis or some other liver disease, it really shouldn't matter whether you're in a physician's office with four people in practice or whether you're getting that test done in a little hospital lab somewhere or even a large hospital lab. The same quality control and quality assurance requirements should be in place, we think. And then the last point in this bill, Mr. Kirkman, it might have been quicker if I had read this. The last point in this bill is that we have a little glitch in our statute that says that if you're a moderate complexity lab, you may perform up to three types of high complexity tests. And these are the most advanced kinds of things. And that practice, in other words, this little clause in our law is really not allowable under CLIA. Under CLIA, either you're a moderate complexity lab or you're a high complexity lab, and you can't mix and match the two. And so we just need to get this taken out of our law so that we'll be in compliance with the federal law. And I want to point out that no Oregon lab has exercised this option or expressed any interest in doing so. This isn't something that anybody's doing, so it's not, we don't think it's going to create a problem for anyone.
You're not going to be all of a sudden reining in somebody on something they've been doing for 15 years.
So anyway, to summarize, that's our bill, and it makes our clinical lab licensing law consistent with the federal law, and it changes our licensing fees so that for the next biennium, we'll be able to continue the exempt program.
Do you have further to add, or just?
Chairman Fisher, no, I do not.
Okay. Any questions?
As usual, Mike said it all.
No,
you do it so well.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing. I always love that, Mike.
Okay, well, looks like we'll go right out of our public hearing into a work session on Senate Bill 2175A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Shields.
I'd move 2175A to the floor of the Senate, but do pass what I'm going to do.
Senator Shields has moved the House Bill 2175A to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Senator Shields will carry the bill. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2175A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2179A.
Mr. Chair, before Mike gets out of the room, Mike, I'm going to read your testimony for my speech. Is that okay? When I carry the bill.
We have no testimony on it. I'll have you and the question since we have no one that wishes to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2179A comes to the committee from the House Committee on Human Resources. The vote was 7. Basically unanimous, there were 2 excused members. What the bill does is it authorizes the Oregon State Board of Nursing to conduct investigations and exemptions of certain certificate holders, licensees, and applicants. It eliminates certain notice and hearing requirements, increases minimum amount of civil penalty that the board may impose, creates exemptions to nurse, patient, and psychotherapist patient clinics. And it left the House floor unanimously, or pretty close.
59 and 1 absent and 1 excuse.
Mr. I was going to ask you if you didn't have that 1 no, and I was curious, who's the Lynn Hannon over in the house? He's nasty.
I'm not going to dignify that remark with a comment. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2179A and open a work session on House Bill 2179A.
Mr. Chair, I move 2179A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2179A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher? Aye. And Senator Duncan for making that wise crack. We can carry this bill.
We might pass it on to Senator Hannon.
I'll see if I can get Senator Hannon to vote for it. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2179A and open a public hearing on House Bill 3030A. Lori Marzell and Ed Hughes. Good morning.
Morning, sir. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed Hughes, I have with me today Dr. Lori Marzell, naturopath. She's the former chairman of the State Board of Naturopathic Examiners. We have a relatively simple bill for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Lori Marzell. I've been in practice for 19 years, and I'm here representing NMEI, Naturopathic Medical Education Institute. And we are in favor of House Bill 3030A. The reason for this bill is some probable erroneous wording in our statute, which is not in compliance with another part of the statute, causing a tremendous amount of confusion in the profession. When we first established the formulary council, it was added in statute 685-145, and this was a body that was whose task was to make a list of substances that naturopathic physicians could prescribe. This list was supposed to facilitate the pharmacist in filling prescriptions for naturopathic physicians. In doing so, someone apparently thought that that list should be noted in the definitions part of our statute. The definitions state all the substances we may use in our practice. And those substances include not only prescription items, but many non-prescription items like vitamins, minerals, diet, and things like that. So what they did is just put in the substances listed in 685-010 that we can use is the exception. So it's a little difficult to read, but it's non-poisonous plant and animal substances and therapeutic dosages, food and water as recognized in the formulary. Well, we don't want water in the formulary, and we don't want food in the formulary, and that would encumber the pharmacist. So what we'd like to change that to is non-poisonous plant and animal substances and therapeutic dosages, food and water, the substances listed on the formulary, over-the-counter substances, non-prescription, non-DEA-regulated homeopathic substances, and nutritional supplements. When we presented this, now, this bill should clarify what is within our scope of practice, and all the substances that we've listed are listed in the statute, and I have on the second page of the testimony I'm handing in exactly where in the statute those can be found. This is not a bill to expand or change scope of practice at all. This will, in effect, bring this aspect of the statute into compliance with ORS 685-145, where it defines what the formulary council does. When we presented this bill in the House, the medical lobbyist for the Medical Association requested that we add non-prescription, non-DEA regulated to the homeopathic substances. At present, I don't know if the senators are familiar with homeopathic substances, but there are no prescription homeopathic substances or drug enforcement agency regulated homeopathic substances. But in case there were, we have absolutely no objection to those being, if they're a prescription item, they should be on the formulary. So they would be included under substances listed on the formulary, and the non-prescription homeopathic, which is currently all the homeopathic items, would be listed separately. So so we then decided that that would be a good amendment to add on. I also am handing out a statement of support from Joe Schnabel, who has served on the Formulary Council ever since its inception for about 10 years. He's the former head of the Pharmacy Board and current member of the Pharmacy Board, and the Pharmacy Association is also in support of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3038 and open the work session on House Bill 3038.
Yes, Senator Shields. Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3038 in gross to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves House Bill 3038 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation for the discussion. Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Senator Shields has volunteered to carry House Bill 3038. It is carried. It is passed. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3038 and open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 53. We have Representative Walker with us this morning. Good morning. And Lisa Ellen,
yes.
Linda Ludwig.
I think that one is me. It's a little hard to figure out how we're going to pronounce that.
Okay.
be in my glasses. Won't help me on that.
No, unless they have a phonetic spelling in the lenses. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Vicki Walker, State Representative for House District 41 in Eugene and Springfield. And I'm here today to ask that you support the House Joint Resolution 53 that passed out of the House on a unanimous vote. It declares that suicide prevention is a state priority, and Mr. Chair, you are very familiar with this issue because I was in front of your committee in 97 asking you to support the youth suicide prevention coordinator position, which you most generously did. And I think a lot of things that happened, and I'm very grateful that we have the coordinator because she just returned from Grant and Harding County, where they've had 3 suicides in 3 weeks. And he's 4 now. Oh, okay, so we have 4. As you know, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the second leading cause of death of our young people in Oregon. It only trails behind accidents and unintentional injuries. This is frightening. As you may or may not be aware, I am a survivor of teen suicide. I attempted to take my own life when I was 17 on 4 different occasions. And, you know, it's my goal to make sure that we save kids' lives. We need to let them know that their problems are not insurmountable. We have discovered there are a number of needs that are going unmet, mental health counselors in the schools, and a number of issues. And we recognize through this resolution that one method is not going to take care of all of this. We simply want to bring the awareness to the members of the legislative body. The Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator organized a series of 13 community forums this legislative session, during session, and I facilitated the one in Eugene. Over 500 people attended those forums, and that tells me there's a lot of interest. We had survivors attend, we had parents, mental health professionals, and a lot of folks who care about this issue and want to see us do something. I had a statewide teen crisis hotline that I introduced this session, and because there was no money other than the general fund, it died in committee. But hopefully, with the information we come out of the forums, that has come out of the forums, we actually have a meeting in Portland tomorrow to digest all of that information, and we'll develop some very clear strategies that I definitely will be back next session to push for funding for those things. At this time, would like to give Lisa and Linda a chance to talk unless you have some questions.
Okay. I just wanted to make a comment to this Representative Walker. I just said, Oregon is lucky with your survivor. I'm just amazed and admire your openness and what you've done in bringing issues forward. And I think you just made a great contribution to the state.
Thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate that. It is a great personal risk that I bring my story forward. It caused some anxiety with my daughter that I would be so reviewing of my personal life. But to me, it's so important to save other kids and other lives. And if I can share my experiences to help that make that happen, then it's worth it. And, people like Linda, whose son has died, too, that I appreciate and admire for coming forward and helping us. Thank you.
I think the committee would want me to echo Senator Duncan's statement, too. I was thinking the same thing. Appreciate the fact that you put your time in on it and that you're concentrating your efforts to make a difference.
Thank you.
Well, that's a full step in line with our work.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, I come to you this morning as a member of the Governor's Youth Suicide Prevention Task Force that took place several years ago. Mr. Chair, you probably remember that culminated in the bill that brought forward the coordinator from last session. I I just want to support the bill. I think it's very important that we get more recognition of the importance and the tragedy of youth suicide in our state and make it a priority. It touches too many lives, lives that we would never suspect, including my own. And I urge you to support the bill. And in subsequent sessions, if we can, bring forward some resources to address the problem.
Chairman Fisher and Committee, I'm Lisa Miette from the Oregon Health Division. I'm the manager for a unit in injury prevention and child fatality prevention. The youth suicide coordinator is an employee in my unit, and one of our priorities for prevention is youth suicide. I want to echo the things that Representative Walker has said, and particularly the parents that have lost children. The stories are striking. One of the things that when I sit and talk with them that I hear over and over again is, in retrospect, how come I didn't recognize this? How come I didn't see it? I can look back and see the signs. One of the things that we're going to struggle with over the next few years is helping people to see through the myths around suicide. There are myths around suicide that people believe. I mean, I've sat with medical examiners that have told me, well, if a child wants to kill themselves, they will. That's not, if a child wants to kill themselves, they will. That's not necessarily so.
Bring up something that I've just been thinking about here and wondering, really, is there any statistics as to maybe how many suicides were not necessarily really intended to go through with it, actually, and not to either discovered in time or more serious than and I think back to a grade school friend of my brother's, and we were a small town, and we knew the family well, and he was having some marital problems, and he and his wife were separated, and he called her up and talked to her on the phone, and while he was talking on the phone, he shot himself in the side of the stomach, thinking that you know, it wouldn't be a fatal thing, but it would get her sympathies back on his side and hit some kind of an artery there and bled to death before they could do. She could even have help sent over to his house, and it was pretty evident that he, you know, hadn't really intended to maybe go the whole way, but it didn't turn out like he'd anticipated. And I just wondered, you know, how often, I know in my own particular case, and I think I mentioned it a couple of years ago, had a daughter that made a rather weak attempt at suicide, and obviously had covered it up extremely well. And as I look back, I've analyzed this thing for years, there was nothing that she did that gave us any indication. Yeah, we knew she was struggling with the idea of going blind or anything, but there had never been anything, and even talking with her friends or anything, right until she finally made the attempt. There was nothing to show, nothing to gauge that that was taking place. And she gone ahead and finished high school successfully, and you know, it seemed to be accepting of it on the outside, but on the inside really wasn't. And yet, with all the planning that she did, if she would have planned as thoroughly, you know, and really desired to go through with it, she surely would have been able to have done it. And so I was wondering, did these things sometimes go astray? Is there any way of measuring that? Or, because this is something that I see that's so insidious about it. If someone attempts to do this, not really wanting to have it, but wanting to make a statement, wanting to use it for a shock type thing, how many of these backfire and wind up being fatal?
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, the language that you're struggling for, and it does exist out there in the field of research and study around youth suicide and suicide in across populations, is the difference between a gesture, a suicidal gesture, and suicidal behavior that ends in either a death or a significant injury. And researchers do believe that there are differences between those three populations. at the Health Division, we collect statistics about those three populations. And last year, in kids under 18, 20 children died due to suicide. 778 visited ER rooms as a result of an attempt to hurt themselves. And over 35,000, it is estimated by the YRBS survey, report suicidal ideation. That's in 1 year. Now, for every one of those children, we know that they have at least, this is one of the things we gather information on, about 25 people that are affected significantly by their behavior, by relationship to them, either acquaintances, friends from school, parents and family. So the impact and the magnitude of the people that are affected by suicide is fairly vast. Your question about how can we learn more about the differences between those three groups, because I think they are significant, is through a method of research called psychological autopsy on folks that have died by suicide. And what happens is a researcher spends time with family and friends doing an investigation of the psychological, family, social, spiritual, educational details around the background of someone who's died by suicide and completes a report about that. Another method of investigation that is fairly new that we're looking at right now to implement is investigation of people who have had attempted suicide and not died by suicide to discern the differences between those two groups. We believe they're real. One of the things that people who work in mental health will tell you is that about 90%, and some estimates are even higher, up to about 93% of people who do suicide do have some sort of, on retrospective study, some sort of psychological illness, a psychiatric illness that can, on retrospective study, be identified.
Yes.
Mr. Newbitson.
No, I go ahead.
Well, I have a couple of questions. I've seen the statistics that show that if you teach driver's ed, that maybe you've seen them too, that the accidents go up. And if you, when they, the sex ed, the unplanned pregnancies increase, and the drug and alcohol. I found out in the driver's ed that there is a driver's ed program that works, the one that's endorsed by ODOT, because it has a different approach. And it rather than the Department of Ed, because they've learned some things, and it has a track record of reducing accidents in young people. And so my question is, I just got back from Colorado and with family, and that school, for one thing, was big in deaf education. The kids went through the graveyard. They wrote their obituaries. They designed their tombstones. And there is this whole deaf education. And there are people there that believe this fascination with death. And even in the school curriculum. Do you have any comment on what deaf education is doing to the young people?
I'm Chair Fisher, members of the committee, Senator Shannon. One of the things that we're really, really clear on is that sharing information when there is a critical incident, how it's done, has significant consequences for particularly children, particularly around violent losses, whether they're suicides or homicides. It's really bad practice for a principal to walk into a school and turn on the intercom system and report that 25 children have been shot in Colorado. And that's one of the things that happened at Thurston High. We don't encourage that. It's traumatizing. One of the other things that we're aware of is that memorials around deaths can significantly disturb children and cause the preoccupation that you're talking about. And what we would rather encourage people to do is to do debriefing that helps to de-traumatize them and lower the anxiety and the pain. One of the things that I keep holding up to people that I saw Katie Kirk do, and I was with people from Colorado just after the shootings and from Denver from the State Health Department there in Seattle at a meeting that I was at. And one of the wonderful things that Katie Kirk does is she without training, went on TV and did what we call in the field critical incident debriefing. She allowed people to debrief from their experience, and in the process of it, and we talk about vicarious traumatization when whole communities are traumatized by an event. They might not even know the people who have died, but they're all traumatized. And so critical incident debriefing is really important. There's a role for media to play in that. There's also a role for individuals can be trained to do this, and there are youth around the state up in Battleground and in Portland who have been trained to help in the debriefing process. People can be trained to help debrief and help lower the levels of anxiety and probably negative preoccupation that you're talking about. And that's an area where we really can do some work and really help people.
The parents that talk to me about this deaf education, and it's not just in Colorado, it's all over Oregon too. They take field trips to the graveyard and all of this fascination with deaf. And I just think there is a problem because what you said a minute ago, and I cannot quote you, but you talked something about the spiritual part. And for teachers to try and totally teach about deaf without acknowledgement of so many kids that the faith and their parents' faith and all that. I just don't think unless the teachers are allowed to adequately teach what they believe to be true and then, you know, the parents come, you know, whatever. I'm not sure that suicide and death are things for the public schools. I'm not against what you're doing. I just want to I have this big thing about a record of success. And are you looking at a curriculum that's reduced suicide someplace? I just think that there's enough information flowing out there that we don't have to, again, tell our kids to eat a guinea pig. And I just, that's my concern, is what are you going to do, and has it worked someplace else?
Chair Fisher, Senator Shannon, members of the committee, those are really, really important concerns. They're concerns that we have also at the Health Division, so I really appreciate your comments. I spent some time at Cascade Community School up in Portland. It's an alternative school with a group of 15 children last week, and we spent 2 hours exploring their questions about suicide prevention and their ideas about, you know, what's good for kids and what's bad for kids, and had some long discussions. And one of the things that they have a concern about is, so my friend tells me that he's going to hurt himself, and among teenagers, there's this, well, I'm not a code of ethics, and I'm not going to tell the old people. And one of the teens at the table said, we've really got to break through that. I've really got to learn to share that information when someone is in danger with an adult that can help. So I need to be able to, number one, talk about suicide and life-threatening behavior in a way that I can reach out and get help when I need to. So break through those taboos. It's important for them to be able to do that. And also, there are teens who believe that they have some responsibility to the children that they're friends with to try to help them. And if they are, and the programs that I'm talking about are peer support programs in which peers reach out to each other, they're natural helpers to each other, and they're supported by adults in doing so by getting counseling, by having support group meetings, and helping them frame their choices with each other and helping them support each other and making healthy ones. So those are the kinds of programs. I don't think we would come with a curriculum around suicide prevention to be inserted into all schools, but we might have some information for one of the strategies that is in the 22-step strategies that we're developing for the statewide plan would be to do in-service training for teachers so that they can recognize signs and symptoms, so that they'll know how to share important information with children without traumatizing them. They'll be able to make good choices around that. They'll have referral sources. They'll know in their hearts how to ask a question. And one of the things that keeps hitting me over and over again, that I know that to be successful in preventing suicide, almost all adults that have some sort of interaction with kids are going to have to learn to be able to reach out and say, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Show that they care and know where to refer a kid for help. And those are three really simple things. We don't need to make everyone a professional in suicide prevention, but we do need to be able to make people aware of how they can help and how they can help.
And if I might respond to that, Cinder, it is so important to ask a child that question.
that it's so important to ask anyone that question, are you thinking about suicide? They want you to ask that question, because I can tell you that most people who are contemplating this method of ending their life don't want to take their life. They're just waiting for someone to reach out and help them. They either don't know how to ask it, or they're so deep in their own despair that they can't figure out how to get out. But if you sense that this is something you're thinking about, don't be afraid to ask it. Asking the question is not going to make them do it. Asking the question could save their life.
Sure. When I really talked about critical debriefing and the role of the media, potentially, in critical debriefing, a two-part question. Has the media done a responsible job of that thus far? Or the second part of the question, are there volunteer education kinds of options for media, reporters and so on to go to,
to
educate them in that arena, since it's becoming more and more of an issue?
Mm-hmm. Chair Fisher and members of the committee, Senator Shields, the CDC, in conjunction with the Centers for Disease Control, in conjunction with some a number of other agencies, convened a meeting several years back, and I cannot remember the date, but they published a document on recommendations for reporting around not only suicide but other violent loss. And we have shared those with media representatives many times, and sometimes in the height of getting a story reported, with helicopters flying over homes and all of the advanced electronics we have now, it's so easy to go overboard and film a piece that is that brings a lot of high anxiety in communities and show it over and over and over again. And that's the one thing that we do want to caution the media about doing. We also know that the media is fairly sensitive to its ratings and the number of people that they can attract to watch incidents. And there is a preoccupation in our society, for good or for bad, with critical incidents. The proliferation of police shows and ER shows and things like that, they're very popular with people. And there's sort of an unhealthy aspect in that when we think about people becoming preoccupied with death and critical incidents. So we encourage the media as much as possible. In fact, I'm working with our public information officer at OHD to develop a workshop that we can invite media personnel to, particularly editors, to come and talk about their role in critical incident debriefing, and that's something we hope to do next fall. Thank you.
And if I might respond to that, Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, what was it last year? Kurt Cobain of Nirvana died. It was last year or the year before. I can't remember this rock group. And my children were watching MTV at the time, and MTV played this whole scenario over and over and over again all day long, and it was really making me angry. My daughter was glued to the TV, and I could see her whole attitude just change because she was going through some rough times during that time. And I just watched her, and I finally turned the TV off, and I said, that's enough. We don't need to watch this anymore. And got her involved in other activities. And then his picture was all over magazines, and that is not the way to talk about suicide. It glorified it, it made it this big deal for young people, and it was just terribly irresponsible. And so I really applaud what the Health Division is doing.
Yeah, I recall in the days of superintendent, I saw one teacher mother was very upset because her son had committed suicide, and the school failed to have an assembly to acknowledge. And, the school is you don't acknowledge it, because the minute you do, you may have someone sitting there who's thinking about it, and all of a sudden you're getting the attention of the PA system or assembly or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a tough one for parents to be in that spot, but you also want to be careful that you don't encourage someone else.
Right. It's sort of the thing with the school shootings. you know, all the copycat school shootings we had. Kids Think national news front page. Some of the, I think one of the Chicago newspapers refused to put anything on the front page about the Littleton massacre. So I really applaud the media for taking that approach. I hope we've answered all your questions. We've taken a lot of your time this morning.
I don't think we can minimize the importance of this evening. Yes, I'm
just wondering if you wanted a motion on the bill.
Well, we need to get into a workstation here, and I was preparing to do that, making sure we had all our testimony. And I didn't know for sure whether I cut Lisa off when I started asking questions. Did you get further?
Fisher, the one last thing I would say is to acknowledge that, you know, in a market economy, one of the ways of working with the media is to work with parents and to help them understand what are good things for your parents to be seeing and what are bad things for your parents to be seeing and how to debrief their kids when there is violence and loss and they're surrounded by violence today and highly traumatized. And so that's a great area of work for us. And parents can really support our work, too. And one of the things about the suicide prevention work is that survivors and parents are going to be really important in our work. And we're including them. We're reaching out and trying to include them in everything we're doing. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
I think that's important because I think in our particular instance, two families made a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
We might not have seen things that we recognize, but by the same token, in the recovery of it, I think we still played a big part.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Thank you.
What was the public hearing on House Resolution 53 and open legislation?
Sure, I move. Move House Resolution 53 to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Joint Resolution 53 to the Senate floor with a new pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections hearing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Chairman?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. The Senator Shields, I see you're on this. Would you like to hear him?
Thank you. Senator,
thank you very much. Yes, Senator.
After you close this, I want to say something.
All right. We will close the work session on House Joint Resolution 53 and turn all this to Senator Shannon.
Okay. Well, I had to turn another meeting at 9:05, and I would like to record it as an I vote on House Bill 2179A and House Bill 3030A.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just the last two.
I will open, can I do that simultaneously?
Sure.
I will open the work sessions on House Bills 2179A and 3030A to record Senator Shannon's vote. How do you vote, Senator Shannon?
Aye, on both.
Senator Shannon votes aye on both House Bill 3030A and House Bill 2179A. And with that, I'll close the sports session. The Senate Committee on Health and Human Services is adjourned.